John Bachman, who pierces people's face. The K is for the kill, L is for the lover, and the M is for the mutiny, and I wish it didn't happen.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my drum?
Now the N is for not, oh no, my phone's just sinking. The B is for the peg leg that keeps me standing up. A Q is for quantum leap, R is for the rum, and the S is for the scurvy, which I wish I didn't get.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg.
That's underneath my boat. And B is for Mukitas, who plays a sour note. W is tie is this, X marks a spot. Why? Cause I'm a pirate.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my grog?
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. Repeat, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Wednesday, January 9, 2012. Extreme weather leaves three Palestinians dead, and Israeli troops arrest seven civilians during invasions targeting West Bank communities. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Three Palestinians were killed as extreme rain, snow, causes floods, casualties and destruction in the West Bank and Gaza. On Wednesday, the Palestinian Civil Defense reported that two women drowned and died in Tul Karim city, another man died in Jenin, and about 15 people were reported injured due to the storm which hit Palestine since Sunday. In other news, the Israeli military kidnapped on Wednesday morning seven Palestinian civilians during invasions targeting a number of West Bank communities. Four residents were arrested when Israeli troops attacked the village of Beit Fajjar, southern West Bank. Palestinian security sources reported that several Israeli military jeeps invaded Beit Fajjar before the soldiers violently broke into and searched several homes, causing damage. Meanwhile, another three residents were kidnapped by Israeli soldiers when they invaded the city of Nablus, northern West Bank. Witnesses said that Israeli troops searched homes and caused damage before arresting the three men. At the political level, Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas stated that he is willing to continue to cooperate with the United States and the Obama administration to achieve a peace agreement with Israel based on the two-state solution. From its part, U.S. State Department spokeswoman Victoria Nuland stated earlier in the week that until peace negotiations between Israel and the Palestinians lead to the establishment of a Palestinian state, the United States will not refer to the Palestinian Authority as the State of Palestine. Her statement came in response to a decree issued by Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas to rename the PA as the State of Palestine and to change the official documents to reflect this modification. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Wednesday, January 9th, news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by Hassan Kassis and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
Afghanistan, 8th of January. The British military is reporting the death of a British soldier from small arms fire and yet another insider attack from a suspected Afghan government soldier at patrol base Hazwat in the Narija Sharaf district, Helmand province. Three other soldiers were wounded in the attack. Afghanistan, 9th of January. At least 250 Afghan police officers were somehow poisoned. It is unclear if the poison killed any of them. Previous incidents of this type have involved poisons added to food. In other words, someone in Afghanistan is poisoning pigs like they were rats or cockroaches. Afghanistan, 8th of January. Unknown attackers fired 8 to 10 rockets into the airport in Kandahar from multiple directions. There have been no reports of casualties or damage, and no group has claimed responsibility for the attack. Pakistan, 7th of January. Yet another U.S. drone strike killed 8 people. This was the 6th drone strike into Pakistan in 8 days. A total of 35 people have been killed by these strikes, with no trial, just an unseen executioner in the sky. Pakistan, 5th of January. At least 25 mortar shells were fired from Afghan soil and hit the border area of Ghulam Khan and Pakistan's North Waziristan Agency. According to Pakistani officials, the shelling continued for 4 hours. Afghanistan, 6th of January. Two suicide bombers hit the District Development Council in Spin Boldak, Kandahar province. 4 civilians were killed and 15 more were wounded. Taliban spokesman Qari Yusuf Ahmadi claims responsibility for the bombing and claimed that 9 people were killed. Washington, D.C., 6th of January. Afghan President Karzai met with several U.S. senators demanding that U.S. forces withdraw back to their bases. The next day, he met with President Obama, presumably making the same demand. Helmand Province, ongoing. The New York Times is reporting that tribal elders, farmers, teachers, and provincial officials have all concluded that the war is lost and they must make peace with the Taliban to ensure their own safety. U.S. troops will either be gone or reduced to lower levels by sometime in 2014, and few in Afghanistan want them to stay. The U.S. has not been successful in controlling the corruption and hypocrisy of regional and local government bodies. As a result, many in Helmand believe the influence of the Afghan national government will once again be confined to the area immediately around Kabul, the nation's capital. Mr. Barack Obama, why wait until 2014 to remove the troops when 2 more years of war won't change anything? Now's the time to pull the plug, bring all the troops home today. The war is already lost, why spend more blood? This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to wsqtradio@hushmail.com. Repeat, wsqtradio@hushmail.com. The 26th of December, the 4th person was arrested for refusing to snitch to a Seattle grand jury investigating Occupy protesters and anarchists. Maddie Pfeiffer, like Matt Duran and Kedio Olgenek, is being held for refusing to snitch. Matt and Kedio have been held since September 2012, and their imprisonment set off a storm of retaliatory attacks by anarchists. On the 3rd of January, this wave of attacks continued with some heavy trashing of a Wells Fargo bank branch in Portland, Oregon. Wells Fargo is famous for their investments in private prisons, making them an especially appropriate target. The following communique appeared on www.anarchistnews.org. Portland banks smashed in solidarity with grand jury resistors. A Wells Fargo in Portland had a window smashed and cracks in several others, along with a rock hammered to the ATM. Respect and solidarity to Matt Duran, Kitio, and Matty, all too strong to cave into the coercion brought by the filthy feds and their desperate yet failing attempts to pull the splinters of our discontent from their asses. Disgust towards all prisons, the banks that profit from their proliferation, and the capitalist state which drags our lives through endless struggle. We queers can't help but to vomit in the dumpster of the ever-sickening, cisgendered, hetero spectacle that surrounds us, and the stench is only growing worse. That's the end of the communique posted on the 3rd of January to Anarchist News. Hey, prosecutors and grand juries, you want to read more communiques like this? You want your masters to be attacked again and again like they were last September? If not, release Matty Pfeiffer, Matt Duran, and Kitio Ojanek unconditionally and still without charges, and end the witch hunt in Seattle against Occupy and anarchists. Otherwise, the history of these attacks indicates it will probably continue. On the 7th of January, opponents of the Keystone XL tar sands pipeline staged a nationwide blitz of action. TransCanada alone had three of their buildings stormed by protesters, along with one of their top contractors and the Canadian Embassy in D.C. Here is a timeline of the day of action, which saw buildings stormed and officers taken over all over the U.S. 10:30 a.m., Houston, Texas. Tar Sands blockaders have taken over the lobby of TransCanada's Keystone XL headquarters. 11 a.m., police arrive at front door, issue dispersal order for protesters in the lobby. At this time, over 100 protesters are inside the building. 11 a.m. Texas time, noon Washington time, here in D.C. Chesapeake Earth First storms the Canadian Embassy, unfurls a banner before being driven out by security forces.
We are here to protest the tar sands heating up of people's land.
Meanwhile, a Lakota activist was outside smudging the building with sage to drive out the tar sands demons.
They keep talking to people, so I invite you to pull your arms down from sky people and destroy these tractors, destroy tar sands.
11:55 a.m., Houston, Texas. Two arrests confirmed so far. First was at rendezvous site for the action, where someone was arrested for impeding an investigation. 11:55 a.m., a pipeline dragon has arrived at TransCanada's offices. This is what we've come to slay! 1:20 p.m., Massachusetts. Massachusetts students locked themselves inside TransCanada's office to protest Big Oil's attempt to lock us in a climate disaster with the Keystone XL. 1:20 p.m., Maine. Activists gathered in front of TD Bank, one of the main financiers of the Keystone XL tar sands pipeline. 3 p.m., Massachusetts students still locked inside TransCanada office in Westboro, Massachusetts. 4:06 p.m., over 50 people storm the lobby of a second TransCanada building in Houston, the TransCanada headquarters at 717 Texas Street. 4:09 p.m., activists in Milwaukee, Wisconsin storm the headquarters of Michelle's Corporation, one of the main contractors building the Keystone XL pipeline.
And we will not rest.
And we will not rest.
Until everyone involved.
Until everyone involved.
In this murderous project.
In this murderous project.
Pays for the destruction.
Pays for the destruction.
They have caused.
They have caused.
For our private property.
Stop building the Keystone Pipeline. Stop building the Keystone Pipeline. Stop.
4:11 p.m. Over 50 blockaders inside TransCanada's headquarters in Houston march pipe dragon around stage die-in. 4:15 p.m., over a dozen cops arrive on the scene with bags full of plastic zip-tie handcuffs. Blockaders chanting, "No tar sands, no way, not ever, not today."
4:17 p.m., Trans Canada spokesman Dodson appears in the lobby, sees the blockaders, and retreats through a door. 4:21 p.m., police force blockaders back onto the street. Everyone is outside except the police liaison. 4:40 p.m., half a dozen mounted police arrive. Impromptu dance party begins. Police do not participate. 4:46 p.m., instead of working, Trans Canada employees are standing on the other side of their glass wall and taking photos. 5 p.m., protesters line up to force Trans Canada and other dirty energy industry employees to drive through gauntlet of shame on their way out of the building. New York City, protesters in front of TD Bank, an investor in the Keystone XL, went so far as to dump tar over themselves to protest the tar sands pipeline. Storming of the Canadian Embassy to protest the Keystone XL tar sands pipeline by Chesapeake Earth First on the 7th of January was explicitly in solidarity both with the tar sands blockade in Texas and Idle No More, a movement of Native American or First Nations people in Canada against both the tar sands mining project and a bill called C-45 that would make it easier for the government to sell their land to the tar sands mines and other destructive industries. Here's what it sounded like as protesters stormed into the lobby of the Canadian Embassy. Little resistance was met until after the banner had been unfurled.
Okay, we are here in solidarity with Idle No More and the tar sands blockade. We are here to protest the tar sands eating up of people's land. It's going to...
Sir, you have to leave.
After being pushed out the door by security guards, protesters went over to the rotunda section of the Canadian Embassy, which is outdoors, where a Lakota activist was smudging the building with sage in the Native American tradition to chase out the evil spirits of the tar sands. And we have the smudge going, sage. Enough.
I invite the past who made agreements, treaties with the Canadian government who has not yet kept their agreements. In fact, they intend to violate them by invading the tar sands and kill off the people. So I invite you to pull your arms down from Sky King and destroy these tractors, destroy the tar sands. Born here in North America, join the Canadians because they have also violated our treaties with us. So we must put our hands together in prayer and solidarity to end this so that it happens never again. Too many of us are dying.
When Secret Service arrived, they were more interested in the burning sage being used to smudge the building with smoke in the traditional manner than they were in the storming of the lobby.
That guy say about there could be a little bit of trouble?
Yeah, he said it was going to be a little bit of trouble and, you know, you need to move on so we don't have any problems. And he started putting his gloves on. Because I heard him snapping. That's one of those sounds you can't mistake for anything else. Glove snapping.
Efforts by Secret Service to intimidate protesters with the No Future in Fossil Fuels banner into crossing the street were a complete failure. After leaving the embassy grounds, protesters remained in front of the embassy for another half hour. Oh Canada! If you don't like the protests and the direct actions that are mushrooming about the Alberta tar sands mining and the filth it spews in the water that Native children must drink, there's something you can do about it. Stop supporting the Keystone XL with your diplomacy. Stop supporting the tar sands mining, and instead, shut down the mines and investigate the people who owned them.
We have never stood by to see a whale die.
Is one whale's life worth war?
Until you find something worth dying for, you haven't really lived.
Whale wars are on again in the Southern Ocean. In response to an injunction issued by a Japanese-American judge in a U.S. court against attacks on the illegal Japanese whaling fleet, Captain Paul Watson has stepped down from command and handed responsibility for Operation Zero Tolerance, this season's whale defense campaign, over to Sea Shepherd Australia, beyond the reach of U.S. courts. Here's a statement from Captain Paul Watson. For the 35 years since I founded the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society, I have strived to act nonviolently and within the boundaries of the law. Sea Shepherd has never been a protest organization, nor have we engaged in civil disobedience. We are an anti-poaching organization established to uphold international conservation law. We operate within the guidelines of the United Nations World Charter for Nature that allows for intervention by non-profit, non-governmental organizations and individuals to uphold international conservation law. During Sea Shepherd's long history, we have never caused a single injury to any person. Although we have broken some bureaucratic regulations like Canada's so-called Seal Protection Act, we did so to challenge the validity of these regulations, which were in contradiction to the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms. In all other respects, we have always operated within the boundaries of the law, both international and national. In 1998, Sea Shepherd USA complied with the order by the United States Coast Guard to not approach within 1,000 yards of the Maka whaling operation in Washington State. I myself have never been convicted of a felony crime. And for this reason, the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society in the United States and myself as a U.S. citizen must comply with the order by the Ninth Circuit Court of the United States. Because I have been personally named in the injunction, I have resigned as the president of the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society in the United States and as president of the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society Australia. I have also resigned my position of executive director of Sea Shepherd Conservation Society USA and will hold no paid position with Sea Shepherd anywhere Sea Shepherd is registered and operates as a nonprofit organization in any nation. I have also stepped down as campaign leader for Operation Zero Tolerance. Former Greens Party leader and former Australian Senator Bob Brown of Tasmania will now hold this position. I have also stepped down as captain of the Steve Irwin. Captain Siddharth Chakravanti of India is now in command of the Steve Irwin. The other three captains are citizens of Sweden, France, and Australia. As a United States citizen, I will respect and comply with the ruling of the United States Ninth District Court and will not violate the temporary injunction granted to the Institute for Cetacean Research. I will participate as an observer within the boundaries established by the Ninth Circuit Court of the United States. This includes a statement by Captain Paul Watson concerning his resignation as the leader of Sea Shepherd and Operation Zero Tolerance in response to the injunction from the U.S. courts. So much for your injunction, whalers. Hope you are ready for another season of Rob Fowler's smelly butyric acid and running with your tails between your legs for thousands of miles while the whales swim free.
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 90.5 FM from Washington, D.C. If you can hear this signal and you like what you hear, send an email to WSQTRadio@hushmail.com. Repeat, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Last fall, the Occupy Wall Street movement unexpectedly spread from New York City's Zuccotti Park to hundreds of other encampments and protest sites across the U.S. and the world. The activists' condemnation of corporate greed, economic inequality, and the corrupting influence of money in politics resonated with millions of people around the globe suffering through the worst economic collapse since the Great Depression early in the 20th century. To protest veterans and students of history, it was not surprising when this powerful new movement was the target of police repression. By late fall, Local police commanders across the U.S. employed brutal tactics against Occupy activists, better suited to confronting a terrorist threat than a group of citizens engaged in lawful and nonviolent peaceful protest. While police action effectively broke up most of the Occupy encampments, the movement's activities continue today, but much of it below the media radar. It was learned early on, through statements by Oakland Mayor Gene Kwan and an anonymous Justice Department source, that the FBI and U.S. Department of Homeland Security had helped coordinate local police actions suppressing the Occupy movement. Now a new batch of FBI documents, obtained by the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund under the Freedom of Information Act, reveals the extent of government surveillance targeting Occupy and law enforcement agencies' collaboration with many of the same big banks targeted by Occupy Wall Street protests. Your reporter spoke with Heather Benno, staff attorney with the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund, who discusses her group's successful fight for the documents and what they reveal about the government's perception of the threat presented by the Occupy movement.
In these records, we see a vast surveillance involving the FBI, the Department of Homeland Security, the NCIC, and in addition, local police and private security or corporate security, or in other words, corporate interests, the very interests that the Occupy movement sought to expose as being problematic and related to the income disparity in the United States. So the records really span, they come from across the country. We had to press the FBI, which originally wanted to limit its search to its headquarters or central index. We had to press the FBI to actually release documents from field offices. So we got records from, you know, ranging from Alaska all the way to Florida, California, Arizona, and the East Coast. So we got about 100 records, just about over 100 pages of documents, and the documents are highly redacted. So there's a lot of information that we're still fighting to get. And it's clear from the documents that we have received that we haven't received the entirety of what the FBI actually has. So this is only one part of what we have done. We've already also received documents from the Department of Homeland Security, various productions, the National Park Service, which was involved in the law enforcement response here in Washington, D.C., and some very interesting responses from the CIA, which didn't actually produce records to us. So the take-home message from the FBI records that we recently received, some important information, was in essence the fact that the FBI was working with private security and Wall Street-related interests, banking interests, even before the Occupy protests began.
That's interesting, and maybe you could talk more about that. What indications do we have that there were infiltrators involved in the Occupy Wall Street movement reporting on some of the early meetings that occurred before the first protest was launched in Zuccotti Park on September 19th, 2011, given the fact that your records indicate there were reports coming through the FBI in August of 2011?
Right. The earliest record that we received from the FBI was as early as August 19th, 2011, about a month before even one encampment was set up in Zuccotti Park in New York. And this was the FBI in New York meeting with the New York Stock Exchange, not ironically, to discuss the upcoming Occupy Wall Street protest. So already at that point, when the FBI had received information that there were to be some kind of political protest or, you know, organized First Amendment protected activity, not only was there monitoring going on, information collection, but that information was literally being turned over to those very interests that the protest movement stood against. And, you know, that was the beginning, but it's not the end of it all. We have records from Virginia, from Richmond, Virginia, from Anchorage, Alaska, from Biloxi, Mississippi, and other places where the FBI, in essence, because of certain legal restrictions on its ability to surveil First Amendment activity, was collecting information through proxies, in essence, working with the Federal Reserve, for example, in Richmond, Virginia, which had sent undercover or representatives without saying who they were to Occupy meetings, and those representatives of the banks were then reporting that information back to the FBI.
When you look at all the surveillance that surrounded the Occupy Wall Street movement as it was growing around the country, do you see a deliberate and centralized government effort to surveil and eventually crack down and crush the movement? Or was this something that naturally grew out of the anti-terrorism enforcement agencies that were set up around the country looking for something to do? They have to justify their existence. So is it possible that their surveillance of the Occupy Wall Street movement grew out of the fact they needed to do something and they really had maybe nothing else on their plate?
You know, it's hard to speculate about their motivations, except for the fact that they were meeting with private interests, banking interests, and the very interests being protested, for example, the ports on the West Coast, throughout. So that would indicate not only that, you know, they're collecting information because they receive all of this money, all of this federal money. I mean, we've seen the congressional hearings and congressional reports on the fusion centers and essentially how much money they receive and where it's going. And these documents show that it really is truly going to fund a coordinated effort of collecting information on lawful protest movements. So they're collecting the information, and then what are they doing with it, though? Rather than, you know, using that information in some way to protect people, instead, the information is being used to protect Wall Street. So that indicates a certain allegiance and a certain, you know, strategy on the part of at least certain elements of federal law enforcement to protect Wall Street at the expense of regular working people.
That was Heather Benno, staff attorney with the Partnership for Civil Justice Fund. Find more information on the government's suppression and surveillance of the Occupy Wall Street movement on our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org.
Woke up this morning, you got yourself.
Fucking Democrats talking about gun control. Ask Anaheim pigs what them guns are for. First thing a dictatorship does, ban guns. First thing a real democracy do, ban drones. I'm a dreamer, wanna live in a world without guns popping. Not a world where only the cops got them. Wanna know where the U.S. is headed? Look to Greece, where immigrants are terrorized by the fascist police. And when the shit hits the fan, they want you helpless, unable to defend yourself against state violence. Fuck that, if you ask me, it ain't about guns. It's about the way we fall beneath the cracks as the world turns. Alienation, hyper-individualism, death of communities, social service systems. Americans are stressed out, more so than the rest of the West. And the media is greedy, so they blow it up. Advertisement booms and Wolf Blitzer might get a Pulitzer. This TV mass murder's out for fame. Why I wanna know Jake Holmes' name? They provide the oxygen for these toxic flames. News is for profit, the world is insane. It's what they did in Sweden, no more coverage in press. No mass deaths, no copycats lacking mental health. Go to Iraq, kill kids, that's fighting terror. Psychopath, go to school and slaughter kids and it's murder. No logic, we celebrate Columbus Day. Violence is how the state treats poor community. This shit is close to my heart. My wife's a school teacher, and my homie saw Batman the opening night in Denver. Secondhand friends got that Jake Holmes treatment. In Iraq, 100,000 got that Jake Holmes treatment. I don't own a gun, but I'm hella glad so many of my homies have some. If you're being robbed in your home, the police won't come fast enough, and rapists won't rape no more if you blast them up. Yup. Stop looking for simple solutions to complex problems. There's 300 million of us in this country, and we are all alone. In this world, all you got is your problems, and the Facebook status update won't solve them. We're working more hours for less money. People living here got more stress than any Western country. Break down a community, family is a symptom of that. If your brain is a mess, we got Prozac for that. Modern psychiatry is little more than drug dealers. Only rich kids can afford it. This is a song about alienation, about a mental care system that don't address problems. Hyper-individualism, how capitalism turns men and women into nodes in a digital world where people don't talk no more. In the streets, people don't walk no more. Everyone's a zombie on a smartphone, playing military shoot 'em up games in the comfort of your home. I don't like guns, but I fired them before. But it ain't gonna fix what's sick. It's not like in the hood, folks are waiting 60 days for a license. You buy that shit hot and scrape off the serial numbers. What if in the 60s guns were banned? No beacon defense protecting blacks from the Ku Klux Klan. No Black Panthers, no civil rights, no enter British British rule, no prospect for class war here.
To the core, these are symptoms. Who do you blame when the killers are also the victims of a civilization in steep decline? We don't look out for you and yours. You're all alone. You're all alone. You're all alone. You're all alone.
You got yourself, 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 yourself. You got yourself, yourself, yourself. You got yourself, yourself, yourself. You got yourself.